Hello, and welcome to Profiles. I'm Adam Schwartz, and our guest today on Profiles is travel journalist Sally McKinney. Sally McKinney has traveled in 33 countries on 5 continents. Her travel articles and photos have appeared in many publications around the world. Her books include Adventures in Nature, New Zealand, The Indiana University Experience, Hiking Indiana, and other guidebooks to Indiana. Sally McKinney is a native of Valparaiso, Indiana, and when she's not traveling the world, she lives here in Bloomington. Sally, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you, Adam.
It's good to have you here. I thought we'd begin with a little discussion of what it's like to actually be a travel writer. I imagine some people look at that as a very glamorous profession, an exciting profession, or maybe a dangerous profession. So could you give us a little glimpse into what it's really like to be a travel writer?
In the beginning, it's like jumping off a cliff when you go full time and you try to depend on it for income. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's been a roller coaster type of income and experience because there are all sorts of ups and downs. So it takes a lot of adroit footwork to look ahead and project income and make sure you can keep going with it. Mm-hmm. But it's a career I love, and it's worth the cost in stress, I think, to be able to do that.
Now, how long have you been a travel writer?
I started full-time in 1985, and before that I was raising teenage children and could not really get free to travel, so I freelanced and did business and technical writing in the Lafayette area. So that was excellent preparation for going full-time to write about travel, and I used what I learned during those few years when I began working with publications.
Mm-hmm. Do you usually find your own assignments, or are they does someone assign you to write an article or a book?
I've done it different ways, and what worked really well for me in the past is to find the stories myself, to try to anticipate what the editors might want and try to stay ahead of the curve, and then to write the material totally until it satisfied me and then send it out for syndication. And I began doing that in the late 80s. And at that time, I was living on the West Coast in the Seattle area, and I was traveling frequently and learned in a workshop how to send reproduction quality duplicate slides along with the complete text. And I was told that that's what the editors of travel sections of newspapers wanted to have coming in. And fortunately, it worked for me, although I went through a period in the beginning where I really had to have faith that it was going to work. I had to turn out something like 9 or 10 features without getting any feedback that anything was going to sell.
Wow.
And I was living in a tiny basement room that I called the dungeon. And I had no shelves, and so I put the material for all the features along the edge of the floor. And all of a sudden, they started selling. Mm-hmm. And the first feature I sold had to do with Indiana, and it sold in Chattanooga, and I was really, really pleased. And then the checks started coming in, and the clips started coming mm-hmm. in, and I could keep going from then on.
Mm-hmm. Now, before that, you had what you have described as a very conventional life. So how did you move from the conventional life to the life of a travel writer?
My conventional period lasted up until about age 40. Mm-hmm. And the problem for me then was that my marriage ended. Mm-hmm. And my former husband was clearly in love with the 23-year-old and wanted to end the marriage with me and our 4 children. And it occurred to me that I didn't want to be married any longer to someone who didn't want to be married to me. Mm-hmm. And so the next problem I had to deal with was that I got custody of the children. Mm-hmm. And so I had to raise those children. And there's no way around that. And even now, I have a photographer I like to work with, and he's raising a daughter, and there are issues there that he has to make decisions about before he can get free. And in an email yesterday, I said, you absolutely have to raise those children. That has to be done. You can't really delegate that too much. So it took me another 9 years after the marriage ended, during which I did freelance business and technical writing. It took me those 9 years until the children left home. Mm-hmm. During that time, I did a lot of reading. The year before I started working full-time as a freelance travel writer, it was more like a sabbatical. It was a period where I just wanted to hide away and read, and I read all sorts of publications just because I wanted to. And even when my favorite cousin stopped in at the door of my apartment one Sunday afternoon and I had planned to read, I thought, oh, no, I'm going to have to go out and talk to somebody and we're going to have to be social. And I just wanted to hide away and read. And I think that helped set me up for appreciating the written word and being able to write what the editors were looking for.
So you had a kind of retreat.
Yes, I knew to do this. And that's a pattern that's repeated every 6 or 7 years or so, I feel a need to hide away and read. And I've just been through a period of about 6 months of that before entering the next phase of my life. I'm just crazy about reading, and I just have to read, and I can't get enough of it until I get enough of it, and then I can stop reading and do something else. So I think sabbaticals are extremely important for any number of people, not only academics.
You focused a lot on countries around the Pacific Rim.
Yes.
What is it about that – well, it's a pretty big part of the world, but what is it about that part of the world that captivates you?
The thing that helped me make that decision was all the reading I did during the mid-'80s. I read at one time that the balance of trade for the United States had shifted from a European orientation to the Pacific Rim. And at that time, most of the travel writers were traveling to and from Europe. They had studied French and Spanish and German in school. They had the languages that I didn't have. They had the experience in Europe that I didn't have. And I thought, well, there's the whole rest of the world out there. And there's the Pacific Rim. And it seemed that since trade had shifted toward the countries on the rim, that would be extremely interesting. And it's been a good decision for me because it's been fascinating to travel in those areas. And I'm not finished yet. I want to keep going there.
How so? What do you find fascinating about that part of the world?
The difference in cultures, the diversity of cultures. From a distance, it looks as if the Chinese and Japanese and Korean characters are the same and they're really different. From a distance, things look more similar and you get up close. And Thailand and Malaysia are very different, for example. I've been in Southeast Asia at least 3 times, and I want to go back. I'm hoping to go back before the end of this year.
You wrote in one of your bios that you travel with the same enthusiasm that you had when you were 11 and you were 11 years old and you were bicycling into unknown countryside.
Exactly. And even now I get out on a hiking trail and I think, wow, I'm age 11 again. I feel like 11 again. And never mind, it's many years since I've been 11. But during that period in my life, I was very active in the Girl Scouts. I had excellent leaders who encouraged me to develop my talents. When I went to summer camp, everything was very clear about what we were expected to do and not do, what the rules were. if we were asked to clean up the cabin, we were to do it in 10 minutes or we wouldn't get to go swimming or something of that sort. So I worked very fast. So I really liked that combination of structure and freedom. And I feel now, looking back, that a lot of my interests and talents were sustained and developed through that period because I worked really hard to earn badges and get into new areas like bookbinding and learn about things, collecting weeds and things I hadn't had a chance to do before, an interest before. So I still have that diversity of interests and that range of interests. And the great thing about travel writing is that I get to go out and do those things and get paid for the same interests and activities.
Now, I get the feeling that for you, travel is a has a lot to do with spiritual growth and challenging your fears and learning about yourself. Would you agree with that statement?
Oh, yes, definitely. And I must say, by spiritual growth, I mean spiritual in a very broad and deep sense. I don't mean any narrow kind of restrained religious sense, but being open to what I experience is a part of it. Listening and learning from other people is a part of it. I don't go into a country with an attitude that I'm going to make everybody else over in the American image or even make anybody else try to be like me. But I go in with a give and take sort of attitude and a teaching and learning attitude and a mutual exchange is what I'm looking for. And I like the idea that I have a chance to be an ambassador of one and be an American in another country who can represent the best of what America stands for.
You've been in some pretty dangerous situations, am I right, or some risky situations?
I don't think anything is as risky as crossing College and Walnut Street as a pedestrian every day when some idiot driver with a can of drink in his car and a cigarette is trying to make a turn. He's not even looking to see that I'm crossing with the walk sign. Now, that's dangerous. The situations I've encountered have been things like having my day pack slashed in Quito, Ecuador, in the historic district. I was on the way to meet someone in a restaurant for lunch. And I knew the situation was tense there because people were demonstrating in the park a few blocks away against the government at that time. This was several years ago. And so people coached me before I even went out that day. And they said, look, Sally, you've got to take your purse and turn it around backwards so the clasp is against your body. Don't let that be on the outside. But I thought beyond that, and I decided all my valuables would be either in the safe in the room, locked up, or they would be in a money belt where nobody would see where they were. And the only things I had in my day pack were a sweater and a notebook that I was taking with me to lunch. And when I was crossing a street, a bunch of people gathered around me and made me really nervous, but I didn't know what was happening. And then I got into the restaurant and put my day pack down on the floor, and I looked at the pack, and it had broken. It's a split. And I thought, well, this is a really good quality bag. What's happened to this bag? It's like broken at the zipper or something. And it turned out somebody had slashed it, but they hadn't found anything because my money for the lunch was in the purse that I had turned facing my body. So you have to be two or three steps ahead of these sorts of things.
Well, weren't you once stranded in a remote section of Thailand?
The Thailand experience came about when I was on Koh Samui, wonderful island, and staying in a little bungalow. And I had read in my guidebook that there were ferries that went back and forth to a nearby island that was even more beautiful. And for some reason, my cash had run low, and I was about to get another advance or cash more traveler's checks and get more cash, but I didn't have much cash. And so I assumed that the ferry that took me to the next island was going to come back later that day, but it didn't. And I got over there and I was stranded with about $6 in cash. I was really, really concerned about what I was going to do. So I walked along a trail just not knowing where I was going to stay and thinking, well, I could always go back to the place where the ferry came in and sit there all night. And I wasn't really keen to do that. So I continued walking down the trail, and a little kid came up, and he had a notebook, and he had photographs in it, and he spoke English. And he said, you know, my family has these bungalows, and they're right on the beach, and they're the equivalent of $2 U.S. a night, and I had the six. So I said, I'm taking it. I went in, and it was lovely. It had romantic netting draped over the bed, and I still have a photograph of the beach, and it showed yet another island with the volcanic sort of peak coming up, and it was framed by palm trees.
Sally, let's take a break and listen to some of the music that you brought. What's the first piece?
I've discovered that I really like freestyle dancing, and one of the numbers that's a favorite is called Follow Me, from an album called Petrini Party. The music is reggae soca, and it's the type of music people play in Trinidad and Tobago. It's by Tony Prescott for the Atlantic label. And the ironic thing is that I've never yet been to Trinidad and have this CD because it was a gift from public relations people.
Music chosen by our guest today on Profiles, Sally McKinney. That was music chosen by our guest tonight on Profiles, Sally McKinney. That was from the CD called Petrini Party. That was the track called Follow Me. It's reggae soca music. Did I get that right?
Yes.
From Trinidad and Tobago. Sally, you do a lot of solo traveling. In fact, I think most of your traveling is done solo. Is that
correct?
Well,
it's a combination of press trips and solo travel. It's overall more satisfying to travel alone because it's more intense. I see more. I feel more. I absorb more. But it's much tougher.
How so?
I always have to watch my bag, be aware of money management. Sometimes I'll travel in a country where I know no one else at all. I have no other contacts. And I travel without very much money, so I try to avoid having to go to a plan B or a plan C. I try to stay with my plan A because I don't have a lot of backup income or other options. So this pushes me to do the trip really, really well and take care of my health so that I can keep going and get it done.
Mm-hmm. Over the years, and you've been writing about travel for about 20 years, is that right?
Since 1985, so that is. Mm-hmm. It will be 20 years on the 1st of August.
What have you learned about traveling solo? Because I think a lot of people would probably be a little daunted about the the prospect of traveling alone to a foreign country?
What happened to me is a pattern where I started with easier stuff. My first international trip took place while I was living in West Lafayette and I was raising children there. And I arranged for someone to stay with them so I could go to Toronto, a foreign country. I was going to Canada. And I thought, this is awesome. I don't know anybody there, and I'm going to be very careful and not have things go wrong. And so I ended up staying for a few days. But I stayed in a modest little lodging where it was easy for me to meet people. And I did meet people, and they were very friendly, and I had a wonderful time. And I thought, well, I could do more of this. And I really liked being free of my possessions, having only what was there with me in the suitcase and not having to cope with all that stuff we all collect and have.
So you took a small step.
Right. I took that first small step, and it went very well. And in general, the larger steps and the more complicated steps have gone well. And so I've taken increasingly larger steps and more challenging steps each time I've traveled alone. So I've worked up to it over time. It wasn't a leap off the edge of the cliff.
So you've managed to build your self-confidence, I guess. I mean, to travel alone thousands of miles away, traveling solo, I guess over the years you've just built up a lot of confidence in yourself and self-reliance.
If you had known me at age 11, I was so shy. And I still have this shy streak. And I'm still a bookish sort of quiet person in a lot of ways because I can be social and I can talk to people for an hour or two. But at the end of that, I just want to go off alone and I want to read more books and I want to do what I want to do.
Well, it sounds like when you're traveling, you're very open to other people, meeting other people.
Oh, yes. And being single and traveling solo makes a whole lot of difference because I have friends who are couples who go together and they're talking to each other. But I am forced as a single person, as a solo traveler, to ask questions. I had to ask directions on the way to the studio this morning. And maybe had I come over here with someone, that person would have known what I didn't know. And so I think it's helped me personality-wise. It's helped me to grow and develop. In fact, I may even do a book possibly with a co-author on the personal growth aspects of travel, especially for women, because I think there's a lot that can be said on this subject. And I think there's a whole book that can be said about personal growth.
So traveling alone perhaps forces you to really communicate with others and to reach out to others.
Right. And it forced me to do that because I couldn't make it otherwise. And had I known there was that much kind of forcing and growth ahead of me, I'm not sure if I would have done it the same way. But I continue to be eager to travel because I know there's the whole world out there. And I'm not willing to sit back and say, well, I'm so old now. I'm really old and people in my age group are either totally retired or thinking about retirement. Retirement is not in my vocabulary because I see it as cutting out of activities I love to do and I'm not keen to do that.
You're listening to Profiles, and this is a conversation with travel journalist Sally McKinney. Do you ever take vacations?
Vacations. My vision of the ideal vacation is to go to a beach and take a stack of books to read and plan to eat really wonderful food and to do long walks on the beach and not do much of anything else. In other words, not to travel.
Do you bring a laptop with you, or how do you collect your notes when you travel?
I still do a lot of writing in notebooks. And they are portable in a way that the equipment is not still. And so I especially like to travel where I can sit down and make notes. It's very hard to walk around and write in a notebook. So I like to do train travel in foreign countries, for example, where I'm seeing things out of the window and I have contact with people right there in the car where I'm sitting. And I can also make notes. That's really very good. And then I can get food as needed.
Do you generally start writing your pieces while you're there at the place, or do you wait until you come back home?
I would like to begin to generate material during the trip, and their technology allows that now, and I'm really keen to do at least some weekly communication if I go back to Southeast Asia soon. But in the past, I have taken copious notes. I'm known for filling notebooks. Compared to a lot of other travel writers, I'll have my notebook filled, and I'll put in drawings, everything I need to know and remember. One of my favorite drawings was all three levels of a small boat in the South Pacific during a trip I did in New Zealand. And then when I looked at those notes later, I had the details on the boat that we were traveling on, and so I could refer to specific parts of that and levels based on those notes.
My guest is travel author Sally McKinney on this edition of Profiles. Sally, you have written about New Zealand, Thailand, and you've also written about Indiana. What is the difference between writing about your home state and writing about a foreign country? Do you look at it with the same kind of enthusiasm, or you're very big on sensory details, I notice.
Yes. Very,
you pick up on what your senses are perceiving. Do you
exactly.
Do you look at Indiana the same way you look at Singapore?
I didn't start writing about Indiana until I had done a lot of fairly exotic travel at some distance. And when I came back from Southeast Asia, I had a chance to do a book about Indiana.
Which book was that?
That was my first book about Indiana, Country Roads of mm-hmm. Indiana. And that came about because I knew there was a Country Roads of Michigan. And I checked the listings and realized that nobody had written an Indiana book. And I thought, well, this is my home state, and I've been to different parts of it, and it might be fun to do that. And I was also sort of tired from long international trip. So I decided I would do this Indiana book. But I wasn't too excited about it because I thought, oh, well, it's just Indiana. And then I took off to do the research. And I had the most wonderful time because I traveled and traveled and traveled around the state and met people and saw things and felt things and enjoyed myself thoroughly. Hmm. And I had expected it to be semi-boring and just the next – I was using it as the next contract I needed so that I could take the advance money and live on it is what I was doing. I did a series of books where I could live on the advance money and have that.
So what was it that changed your experience from, oh, this is just Indiana, to, wow, this is really fascinating. There's a lot of stuff here.
I think getting to see it see it up close, to travel slowly, which I do when I'm riding. When I did that book, I traveled driving a car, and I traveled with a tape recorder sitting beside me, and I could pick it up and describe things along the road. There's the details in the book, if you read it, are things like red-winged blackbirds sitting on a post and things that I would see along the way. And so I paid a lot of attention to what I was seeing and experiencing along the way and put that into the book. And, of course, the problem with taping is you have to take it all off the tape, which is maddening. But it was well worth it because I'm very proud of that first book. A lot of effort went into that, and I traveled every mile of every chapter that I wrote. Mm-hmm. It wasn't done at a distance. I traveled it.
Mm-hmm. So paying attention and seeing things up close helped make it fascinating for you.
Well, yes, and you have to see and taste and feel and experience things when you travel. And part of the problem I have with mass travel and with modern travel is the way people are sealed off from the sensory experiences. And I think the closer you can get to the sounds, the smells, the tastes, and a lot of this for me has to be walking, it has to be getting on a bicycle, it has to be being outdoors, where you feel the warm wind, you can hear the birds, that sort of thing. If you travel in a sealed compartment of some kind, then you're missing all that.
Speaking of taste, you've eaten crocodile kebabs and pit-pit, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
That's a little veggie they have in Papua New Guinea.
It's a grass, isn't it?
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of it there.
How does that work out when you go to a foreign country and they serve you an edible grass or a crocodile?
This came from my childhood. My parents always encouraged me to take at least one bite of something that was new to me, so I've carried that teaching with me. My parents were both teachers, so they were interested in my learning. And so I will try things. Sometimes it helps to have a glass of beer or wine or something when you're taking that bite of a crocodile or a squid or whatever it's going to be.
Sally, you mentioned tasting and feeling and really experiencing being in a place. And I understand that you're involved with something called ecotourism and also geotourism.
Yes.
Are they the same thing or are they different?
Geotourism involves tourism that is sensitive to the environment, and also it involves travel that pays a lot of attention to traditional cultures throughout the world. And the third thing it involves is a fair exchange economically, similar to the fair trade concept regarding coffee. The traveler gives and takes, and the host people give and take. And I believe that that should be a fair exchange, in contrast to a situation where I once watched in Papua New Guinea. There was a woman trying to buy a wonderful Bylon bag. It was very well made, and she negotiated the price down to $2, and I could see that the woman who was selling the bag was really, really uncomfortable with that. Who knows how many hours she spent knotting that bag and getting the colors just right. It was a beautiful bag, and the woman I was with paid $2 and went back to the boat and just crowed about the bargain she got. And to me, I would rather pay a few more dollars for this beautiful bag that was going to be framed on the woman's wall and hang on the woman's wall and pay a fair amount of money. And so that's a part of geotourism as well as supporting and sustaining the traditional cultures in different parts of the world. And I think this is really, really important now. Because there are so many chain operations that are trying to be so similar and trying to expand throughout the world. And there are good things about this, but from the perspective I have, I think it's important that we sustain the rich traditional cultures in different parts of the world as travelers when we go.
Mm-hmm. So ecotourism is an approach to traveling?
I see it now as being a part of geotourism, which is a little much more inclusive concept. And so I'm quite interested in continuing to travel, but selecting the restaurants, the hotels, and the types of transportation that fit into this concept. And actually, I have been doing this for years because I like to travel by bamboo raft rather than by a motorboat. And I like to stay in traditional cottages with thatched roofs instead of the synthetic stuff. And so I've sought this out anyway because it's a matter of taste for me. But I think now it's really important to preserve the best of traditional cultures throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to contribute to that in the things that I write.
So if someone wanted to travel as an ecotourist or with the philosophy of ecotourism, that's something that they can do either alone or in a group. I understand that there are eco-tours.
Yes. Ecology-oriented tours. And the big problem with traveling to far parts of the world is you've got to burn up huge amounts of jet fuel if you go within your 2 weeks vacation time or whatever you have allotted. So I wrestle with these issues because I don't care to do that. And I try to offset that by staying in an area I visit as long as possible and getting as much out of the trip as possible. And I prefer to use eco-sensitive modes of transportation, although that isn't always possible. In different parts of the world, they're putting motors on boats because it's just easier for the boat people to operate that way. And so then they begin polluting the waters around them and so on. So there are the clusters of these kinds of issues that you have to take a look at it and decide where you want to be and what sort of traveler you are.
So travel has certainly changed over the past few decades, hasn't it? I remember there was a movie in the 60s called If It's Tuesday, This Must Be Belgium.
Yes.
Which was a satiric take on these very fast-moving tour groups where you were very isolated in your tour bus. And now there's a different kind of awareness happening. I've heard of vacations where people will work with a scientist who's working in the field, for example. And that's a vacation.
Oh, yes. I love to do that sort of thing. And it might not suit everyone, but I'm always learning. Both mm-hmm. my parents were teachers, and they really encouraged me to learn. And that's still a big part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So the trips that I seek out and enjoy and feel most satisfied to take have a high learning component.
Now, you travel a lot on a shoestring, I understand. Pretty low-budget travel, is that correct? Any tips or advice for someone who would like to do that?
I think you have to do your homework. You really have to know something about the part of the world you're going to next. I just bought a book yesterday on Cyprus because I'll be going there in February. And I will be going this time with a group from the Travel Journalists Guild. There will be 8 of us. I really like going with a small group. I think 8 will be practically an ideal group, and I'll learn a whole lot. I've never been to that part of the eastern part of the Mediterranean before.
Do you have any one place in the world that's your favorite?
I always think New Zealand when I go back to favorite because I have a high level of comfort there. And I love the people. The people are great to be helpful, friendly, and so on. I'm sure the applications to immigrate to New Zealand are piling up now because so many people like the quality of life. There's a very balanced quality of life there. I've lived there two different long periods in my life, once to write my New Zealand book, and a whole lot of things I like about New Zealand.
You once wrote an article for the Herald Times about fears and conquering fears.
Oh, yes. I still have those fears.
Really?
I have serious fears of snakes. It's a phobia. I know what that's about. I know how the fear is a transfer phenomenon and so on. I still have that fear. I try not to let the fear of either snakes or heights keep me from doing what I need to do as a traveler. So I've had to draw the line at jumping out of an airplane with a parachute on. I had a chance to go as part of my research experience for an article I was writing and turned it down. And I watched all the other people jump out with their parachutes and didn't do it. But I did have a snake encounter in Panama that was pretty daunting, even where the guide was concerned, because we were trying to go on a jungle trail to get closer to the howler monkeys. We could hear them. And so I followed the guide, and I said, well, do I need my hiking boots? And she said, no. So I went in my sandals, and she went ahead. She always went ahead. And on this trail was a huge, turned out to be a fer de lance, sleeping.
That's a snake?
Huge, poison snake, sleeping on the trail. And I could see the woman, the guide ahead of me, with her body was shaking, and she could hardly speak when she saw it. It was sleeping on the trail, and she was recognizing, and she was communicating fear to me just standing behind her. She decided we would not go forward. We would go back to the boat. We would turn around and be very quiet. She said at one point, "Do you want a photograph of this thing?" And I said, "No, I just want to get back to the boat."
I ask because it sounds it seems to me that a lot of your career as a travel writer has been done to help you overcome your fears. Is that true or not?
I asked someone once about the term counterphobic, and I think this is a psychoanalytic term, because I try not to let my fears of different things stop me, but I also try to put my activities into a realistic frame where I'm very thoughtful about the risks that I'm taking, and I'm actually very careful about what I do and don't do. And there are things that I – especially when I'm traveling alone, I think, because I'm very careful about not – drinking alcohol in certain situations. Maybe I go out to eat at a place at night in a very exotic, different, dark neighborhood, and I want to be very alert.
So you're a conservative risk taker.
Yes.
In the few minutes we have left, Sally, I wonder if you'd comment on something. You've written that some people claim that they're not getting what they want from life. Because they may not have a sharp vision of what that is. It sounds to me like you've had a vision for what you've wanted for your life, and you've really created that.
I've known this since third grade. In third grade, we studied a unit, which is very avant-garde for that day and age, on Belgian Congo, which is what the area was called at that time. And I saw pictures of people living in huts with thatch roofs and that sort of thing. And I thought, wow, this is real stuff, and it's really out there. And I didn't even dream at that point that I would ever have a chance to go and see and do that. But I was eager and had the interest in third grade.
So you've known that you've wanted to be, or you've had the impulse to be, a travel writer since that time?
It goes way back. It's rooted in childhood, and it's rooted in things I did then, like get on my bicycle and ride out to the spring to get a drink, which was a little beyond the distance my parents wanted me to go, but I wanted to see what was out there.
What advice would you give for someone who wants to take a risk and make a big change in their life, as you have done, from a conventional life to really living your vision? What advice, if any, what have you learned about doing that?
Well, I think one of the patterns that's helped me a whole lot since age 40 is to gradually, over time, reduce the cost and expense of my lifestyle and my home and the way I live as a single person. I don't need all that much space. In Bloomington, I don't need a car. I like to go sit in the library and read. I don't have to own a room that I call a library where I sit and read. If I do that, there's nobody else to talk to. I'd rather go outside my home to one of the coffee houses. Just came from breakfast at the Runcible Spoon. I like the Bazaar Cafe as a study hall, weekdays especially. So I've rethought my life so that I outsource a huge number of things in my life. Mm-hmm. And so the things that I've chosen for my lifestyle are minimal, but my life reaches out into the far corners of the world.
Sally, thanks so much for coming in tonight. It was a delight to have you. My guest on this edition of Profiles has been travel author Sally McKinney. She's written Adventures in Nature, New Zealand, The Indiana University Experience, Hiking Indiana, as well as other books, and many articles that have been published in publications here and abroad. Sally, we're going to go out on the jazz piece by Alex Bunyan. Can you tell us what the name of this is and what made you choose it?
The title is Southern Living, from his album by the same name. And it's not really like the music I heard in Georgetown's Blues Alley, but it's also very well done, and it's really great listening jazz as compared to the kinds of music I like to dance to.
That's it for Profiles. I'm Adam Schwartz. Thanks for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in February of 2005. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily Blacklin, research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.